is a composite of a number of diseases. We used to consider these all to be separate diseases, but now we recognize that they are all a part of the same syndrome or the same cause and effect relationships. So what is it? Well, we know several things that can be associated in the syndrome X cluster. We know, for instance, that cholesterol is involved. It may be called in reports that you read dyslipidemia, D-Y-S-L-I-P-I-D-E-M-I-A, dyslipidemia, meaning an abnormality in fats, blood fats. What is this abnormality? Well, it's generally three things: high LDL, high triglycerides, and low HDL, especially high triglycerides and low HDL. Those two are very common in this syndrome. Now, HDL, as you know, is a carrier. It is a what we call the good cholesterol. It is a carrier for the LDL to remove it from the bloodstream. So it's your good cholesterol. It works for you to bring down the total cholesterol. And yet it makes a part of the total cholesterol. So when you get your lab test and it says total cholesterol 175, and then it says HDL 80, that means your LDL, the bad cholesterol, is only 95, do you see? Because the total cholesterol is HDL and LDL, both of them, as well as VLDL and all the other cholesterol fractions, cholesterol esters and all the other cholesterol fractions. They're all in the total cholesterol. But generally, we only break it down in the laboratory into two or maybe three: LDL, HDL, and VLDL, or very low-density lipoprotein cholesterol. Now, the LDL is the damaging form of cholesterol, and so we need to know what we can do to help the cholesterol. So we gave you this handout, and we will cover some of those things, but not everything. High triglycerides. Triglycerides are made up of three fatty acids and a glyceride spine. Let me just draw a diagram of what that might be like chemically. Here, a glyceride spine with a fatty acid here, and a fatty acid here, and a fatty acid here, perhaps. Now, the fatty acids come from fats. May come from olive oil. May come from peanut oil or any other kind of oil. Where does the glyceride come from? Well, it is a carbohydrate, and it comes from, especially from sugars such as the refined sugars, maybe fructose, maybe sucrose, maybe maltose. But it can also come from white flour and white rice, white spaghetti. We can also get it from brown rice and brown bread and all whole grains and potatoes. And those last are good foods in anybody's book. You know, they're just very helpful foods. So how do they make something that's unhelpful for us? Well, triglycerides are actually beneficial for us. We need a little. But our problem is that we have way more than we need, and then it becomes a threat to the body. Many of our nutrients are of that kind: essential in small amounts, damaging in large amounts. And so if we can recognize that there is an ideal quantity, And we then have the inspiration to avoid that is too much. You'll find that triglycerides are often associated with diabetes and gout and overweight, as well as a bad diet. Now, we've mentioned two things, low HDL and high triglycerides. Next is the insulin resistance. Now, when insulin was first discovered back in the 30s, was it? By Banting and Best. When it was first discovered, it was just universally considered to be good, just like all other hormones. When cortisone was first discovered, it was good, and we would give it just like aspirin. We'd give it for a headache or a stomachache. It was a wonderful hormone, and it just did such wonderful things for people who had discomforts. If you were getting a cold, take some cortisone. That would just absolve you of all problems with the cold or a flu. It was wonderful. And then we began to recognize problems with cortisone. Increased one's risk of getting TB. Well, back in the days when it was first discovered, tuberculosis was a scourge. So it was a problem. Then we began to recognize that cortisone would cause you to have peptic ulcers. Oof, that was not nice. And then cortisone would diminish the effectiveness of your immune system and increase your risk of getting a host of diseases, from osteoporosis to cancer. And so we began to use cortisone with a lot more caution. It's the same thing with every hormone we have discovered. When we make it in the laboratory, it was fine as it's made in the body. When we make it in the laboratory, it can then become a threat to the health. And many other natural products in the body, like interleukin. Interleukin is a substance produced by the immune system that tides you over from the time you are first attacked by an infectious agent until you get your immune mill working to turn out antibodies. It protects you during that period of time. So we purify it, make it in the laboratory, give it to people who have cancer. Well, they didn't fare so well as we had hoped they would. They began to get real problems. Nausea, prostration, just great difficulties, and might even die from the taking of interleukin, which in the body, as the person produces it, it's fine. Now, what about insulin? Well, you all know that people can commit suicide with insulin. They simply give themselves a large dose of insulin. Blood sugar drops out of the bottom, and the person's brain can no longer function on the small amount of glucose that's left in the blood, or none that's there. And so the brain or the person becomes brain dead and may die physically as well as, altogether, as well as just in the brain. So you can see that insulin does have a downside, but everybody is aware of that. What about the person whose blood sugar is normal or maybe a little high, normal or a little high, but they naturally run a high insulin level? So we check in the laboratory for insulin, and the insulin is high, but their blood sugar is normal, not low, as we would expect. What has happened to this person? Well, their cells have come to the place where they cannot respond to insulin. And so, the sugar cannot easily get into cells because insulin is required to allow sugar to get into the cells. And so it's a doomed if you do and doomed if you don't sort of situation. You have to have the insulin to get the cells, get the glucose in the cells. The cells will not receive insulin, and so you can't get sugar into the cells, so you have no nutrients for your cells, and so the person is essentially starving in the face of plenty. A serious situation. And all of their cells begin to deteriorate little by little, little by little, little by little. Well, now how does this come about? How do we get this insulin sensitivity? Well, number one is we have an hereditary weakness. An hereditary weakness. We're born with it. There are certain ethnic groups that are more likely to be involved in this genetic weakness than others. Let me ask you, those of you who are Americans here, how many of you have either Native American Indian or Black African blood? Anybody have that besides me? Raise your hand to anybody who has that, okay? There are a number of you. A number of you, like myself, have one or other of those. If you do, then you're more susceptible. You have a weakness. You were born with a weakness, most likely, because almost all American Indians have a weakness in this regard. And many who are black, who came from Africa, have the same kind of weakness. And so we have to know up front, I have a weakness. Now, am I going to become insulin resistant? Well, that depends. That depends. Who knows what it depends on? Anybody know? On your diet and exercise. Your diet and your exercise. Those are key factors whether your weakness for syndrome X is going to be expressed. And so, what do we have that will be that we can study here? Well, let's just go through a few factors. More syndrome X factors. They're smaller and denser LDL cholesterol particles in the blood and heavy postprandial lipemia. That means blood containing fats persisting for several hours after eating. Elevated uric acid and a low immunity. Increased clotting tendencies. And usually the person will have a greater likelihood for a heart attack. Okay, well, those, none of those sound very good, do they? Let's go to the next one. Obesity and activity, excessive refined carbohydrates, especially sugars, but also white grains, heredity, aging, smoking, and perhaps a low intake of magnesium. Oh, well, that's, we're broadening our understanding of this. Okay, let's go to the next one. How much of a risk factor are these? Well, two studies on heart attacks showed, one of them showed 147 people in three groups followed for 5 years. The most insulin-resistant group, 1 out of 7 had heart attacks, but in the least insulin-resistant group, none of them had heart attacks. Well, let's see. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. 1 of these would have a heart attack in 5 years. You see, it begins to put it down where we can sort of get a handle on what a risk this is. It's a serious risk. And that's just for one of the problems, and that's heart attacks. One of the problems. Okay, let's take the next study. 650 people followed 10 years. The most insulin-resistant group, 8% had heart attacks. All the rest, only 1% to 2% had heart attacks. Again, we can see that it's very common and that probably heart attack heart attacks are associated with insulin resistance. Well, it has now been proven that that is the case. How many Americans have Syndrome X? Well, it's not known for sure, but probably 25% to 30% are insulin resistant. Saw just a recent report that indicated 40% of Americans have insulin resistance. And that would figure to at least 80 million adults. A lot of people. A lot of people. What about worldwide? Is it different worldwide? A little bit. Because Asian people tend to not have this. Certain Europeans tend to not have this syndrome. But everywhere, worldwide, there are people who are inactive and there are people who have a weakness, a genetic weakness, and who eat too much. Okay, can Syndrome X be treated or prevented? Yes. And these are very simple. Regular exercise program. Keep your weight down. Avoid refined carbohydrates. Get plenty of vegetables, whole grains, cereals, nuts, and fruits. That's a simple program, isn't it? Okay. Can Syndrome X be treated or prevented? Short-term fasting, 1 or 2 days a week. Consider magnesium and chromium supplements. Chromium as a support for the pancreas and magnesium as a preventive measure. And the magnesium, if you use magnesium citrate, then 1,000 to 2,000 milligrams of magnesium citrate and chromium picolinate, that's misspelled there, 150 to 400 micrograms of chromium picolinate. Don't smoke. Don't use alcohol. Those are things that can prevent, can help you. Now, let's go to this one. Let's just sum up, before we talk about cholesterol, let's just sum up those things that are part of Syndrome X. Notice that Syndrome X has been recently discovered, the last 20 years or 30 years, and it is a very serious disorder. It's characterized by the blood fats problem, the heart attack problem, the diabetes problem, hypertension, and cancer, and if you're a woman, polycystic ovaries. Those things have been discovered so far. There are probably other parts to Syndrome X, but these are the ones that have been discovered so far. Now, 19% of Americans ages 20 to 74 have cholesterol levels that average out to a mean of 203. Well, is that too high? And the answer is yes. For most of us, the cholesterol should ideally be about 100 plus the age. And of course, this is highest among white, non-Hispanic females. How do we get cholesterol? From the outside, our exogenous sources, by eating food that has cholesterol in it. By eating fatty foods, especially animal fats. And those are almost all animal fats will encourage a rise in cholesterol more than a similar quantity of vegetable fats. And then endogenous, that's cholesterol that's made inside the body. Does anybody know why we need cholesterol? What does it do for you? Is it essential in our bodies, or could we just filter it out and do without it? What do we need it for? The one thing that I say that it's essential for is, somebody can name. No. What is cholesterol essential for?
The membrane.
No. No.
Doesn't it make it stick something?
What was that? To make hormones. Yes, to make hormones. Many of our hormones are dependent on cholesterol. We can't make estrogen without cholesterol. You can't make vitamin D without cholesterol. You can't make testosterone without cholesterol. You see, many of these, progesterone, cholesterol is required to make that. And so you have to have the cholesterol as a substrate for all of our hormones. Almost all of our hormones require cholesterol. So we have to have some. Now, what about oxidized cholesterol? And you will hear about that nowadays. Oxidized cholesterol is cholesterol that has been worked on by oxygen. We might call it burned. Been burned a little, and has made, or rusted, and has made oxidized cholesterol. This is much worse for us than fresh cholesterol, and I believe that if you're going to eat animal products, dairy products, and use the fat of dairy milk, that if you used fresh cream, it would be better for you, at least for your heart and arteries. The viruses of cancer would be the same. The threat of that would be the same. And the knowledge that it came from a filthy animal, that would be the same. But your use of fresh cream would be better than your use of butter or cheese, because of the fact that the longer the cholesterol in these in dairy products, the longer it stays around, the more it is worked on by germs, the greater the likelihood that you're going to have oxidized cholesterol. And this is the form that damages blood vessels very rapidly. Now, as you see here on the handout, cholesterol oxidized outside the body or inside the body. We just talked about butter and cheese. Inside the body, it can be oxidized by free radicals. How do we get free radicals? Well, by smelling exhaust fumes, by drinking city water, by eating too much, by having a high iron level in your blood. Those are all ways that you can oxidize cholesterol inside your body, that you can do it yourself. And then also outside the body, such things as dried eggs, dried milks, cake mixes, candies. Candy? Well, yes, any candy that has animal fat in it, you can expect that it has oxidized cholesterol. Sweet snacks containing egg or milk products. Now, inside the body, insufficient antioxidants. Where do we get antioxidants from? Who knows? Vitamin E? Where do we get that? A pill, isn't it? Where do we get vitamin E? From our food? Plant foods? Which ones? Green leafy vegetables have some vitamin E. Uh-huh. Olives have vitamin E. What else? Whole grains, nuts, seeds. We get vitamin E from those. Soybeans. All those have, and many beans have lots of vitamin E. And then we can oxidize cholesterol by overeating and by being sedentary after a meal. Oh, what a shame. Couldn't I just take a small nap and not oxidize cholesterol after a meal? Probably not. Probably if you lie down after your meals, then you're probably going to oxidize cholesterol. And everybody oxidizes cholesterol a little bit, so we have to be careful to move around a little after a meal. Be a little active. Don't take that as the time to do your siesta. It's not good for you. Okay, carotenoids. Carotenoids. Beta-carotene. Alpha-carotene. Any food that's dark green or bright yellow or orange will have carotene or carotenoids or so forth in it. Vitamin D, selenium, glutathione, vitamin C, all of those are antioxidants. Now let's go to the testing of oneself. Insulin, to test for insulin, is rather expensive, and it's sometimes a little difficult to interpret, but we can always know that the person has insulin resistance the more overweight they are. So if you are overweight, you can just believe, especially if you've been overweight with an increased girth of your abdomen, that increases your likelihood of being insulin resistant and having high insulin levels. Now, high insulin levels, we've talked about the fact that if you took a shot of insulin, that could kill you outright. But what about just producing a little extra insulin? Does that kill you? Not outright, but it does damage your cells. We can think of insulin as being somewhat irritating, and so as it circulates through our blood vessels, it sort of irritates the blood vessels and makes them more likely to take up cholesterol and other fatty substances from your blood, like the triglycerides that have gone up and the LDL that has gone up because the HDL has gone down. And so insulin damages the interior of blood vessels, makes your circulation not so brisk. It also encourages high blood pressure. If you have overweight and high blood pressure, just go ahead and say, my insulin is high. I can save that $150 for the test. Maybe in your lab it doesn't cost quite that much. Now, if you were overweight as a child, chances are pretty good that you developed insulin resistance in childhood and still had it. And just getting a little overweight in adulthood will bring it back full force. We discussed this a good bit in our book, Diabetes and the Hypoglycemic Syndrome. This book has a section on Syndrome X, and the whole book is geared toward helping a person to get rid of the insulin sensitivity, insulin insensitivity that one might have. Okay, now let's go to another thing. This is also homocysteine is also a marker for heart attacks. It, as well as insulin resistance, can increase your risk of getting a heart attack or a stroke or some kind of blood vessel blockage that could represent a problem for you. Homocysteine, notice how it's spelled, because homocysteine without the E after the T is also a substance that we test for in laboratories. Homocysteine does not require any special handling like freezing of the plasma, but is expensive. It costs maybe $75 or $85 and can be a major expense to you if you are getting other laboratory tests as well. The homocysteine may cost as much as all your other laboratory tests. So what can we do to get homocysteine down without even checking for it? It might be good if you are from a family having heart attacks, and that's especially so if your family has heart attacks without very high levels of triglycerides and cholesterol, but your family has heart attacks anyway. Then you probably should get a homocysteine level just to check on that to see if that is your problem. Because with homocysteine, there are certain things that we can do that can bring that right down. Homocysteine can be thought of as being an irritant to blood vessels just like insulin, and can increase one's risk of getting Alzheimer's disease, heart attacks, high blood pressure, Parkinson's disease, cancer. Homocysteine impairs the functioning of the interior of blood vessels just as insulin does. Right here, impairs endothelial function. Endothelium is the lining of blood vessels, and it makes the endothelial cells, which line the blood vessels, stiff so that they cannot pulsate when your heart does. Well, if you have a stiff vessel there, what is that going to do to your blood pressure? Going to make it go up. What is that going to do to your circulation to the tissues around the blood vessels? It's going to decrease it and starve your cells. So you have a starving of the cells, and you have also an increase in blood pressure. So that's a problem with homocysteine. So we then need to know how we can get it and how we get it and how we get rid of it. First off, we're born with a genetic propensity to have high homocysteine level, just as we are to have insulin resistance. An hereditary problem. Born with it. But good news. Any of these three vitamins, folic acid, which is one of the B vitamins, vitamin B6, and vitamin B12, if you take any of those or all of those, that will help to bring your homocysteine level down. So I consider it this way, that if you think you might have a high homocysteine level, then just go ahead and do the corrective measures. Folic acid comes from leaves, but it also comes from oranges, beans, and rice. B6 from whole grains and brewer's yeast, and many other places. And B12, we can produce it in the mouth in sufficient quantity for ordinary use. But if you have homocysteine, I would recommend that you take a supplement of vitamin B12 to help you to get rid of the high homocysteine. Dietary factors, vitamin B12, may be low in some vegetarians, and especially older people who may have a problem absorbing it. Who is the most likely, what kind of person is most likely to get a B12 deficiency? Do you know? What do they look like? Who are they? Is it an Asian person? Is an Asian person susceptible to B12 deficiencies? No. What about American blacks? Are they susceptible to B12 deficiency? No. So who does that leave? Vegetarians may or may not. It depends on their origin. Here is the type of person who is most likely to get a B12 deficiency. Tall. Blue eyes, fair skin, North European extraction. That's the typical person. And we have several of us in here today who are that way, I being one of those. And so this kind of person should know that they are more susceptible and should watch the B12 level. get a B12 level if you are likely to be getting a B12 deficiency. And what kind of person is likely to get a B12 deficiency? Somebody who is very clean, they will get a B12 deficiency. And the fewer germs you're associated with on an intimate basis, the greater your likelihood of getting B12 deficient. So people who live in certain third world countries, like India, Egypt, and so forth, they don't have B12 deficiency in their homeland, but they move to Singapore or Switzerland, and they get B12 deficient. It's too clean there. So they may need to take B12. Older people are more likely. The older you get, the more likely you are to get a B12 deficiency and to have your homocysteine to go up. People who use junk foods, they are also likely to get both B6 and folic acid deficiencies. Folic acid is very high in vegetarians naturally, but because they may have more B12 problem, they can get homocysteine elevation. All right. So to lower the homocysteine, you would simply do what you need to correct those three vitamin deficiencies. How much of a risk is homocysteine? The Framingham study, those who had levels of, let me just check on that for certain. Those who had levels of 15 or above were 3 times as likely to have a heart attack as those whose levels were below 9. Now, I think that being below 10 is probably the ideal for homocysteine, although it hasn't truly been worked out. So if you get your homocysteine level in the laboratory and it's above 15, that's a red flag. Take measures to bring your homocysteine down. But if it's below 10, you can relax. Homocysteine is not going to be a big problem for you. Okay, let's go to another cause of heart attacks and strokes. This is inflammations. This whole category of problems, of inflammations, can be a serious threat to your heart and your arteries. Now, how can we check on whether we have an inflammation? Well, you may know that you have an inflammation. You may just know that you have an inflamed tooth, and it's been inflamed for years. Maybe you've got an abscess or pyorrhea or some other kind of chronic infection or chronic inflammation. That increases your risk of getting a heart attack. Let's say you have a problem with your teeth that has made it so that you have needed several root canals. That also probably increases your likelihood of getting a heart attack or a stroke or a cancer. There are some people who believe that root canals may be associated with an increased risk in cancer. At any rate, if you get in the laboratory a C-reactive protein level, CRP, and it's high, you can know that that's a nonspecific marker or indicator to you that you have an increased risk of a heart attack. Now let's take some other elevated parts that indicate parts of the blood that indicate an increased risk of heart attack. Fibrinogen is one of those. Fibrinogen is necessary for forming a clot, and fibrinogen levels on the higher side represent to you a marker for an increased risk of a heart attack. An elevated white blood cell count is also a problem for you. And just right off the board, you know that vegetarians then would have a smaller risk of heart attacks and strokes because vegetarians have a lower white blood cell count. That's a characteristic of vegetarians. Lower white blood cell count. I like to see the white blood cell count below 5,500 or 5.5. Now there's some antibodies that we get from germs like Campylobacter or chlamydia or Helicobacter or the cytomegaloviruses. All of those can increase your risk of getting heart attacks. Some of these germs have been cultured directly from blood vessels at the time of heart surgery or blood vessel surgery. Many germs and viruses cause trouble to your blood vessels. They may destabilize an existing plaque. So here you are. You have a blood vessel that has, here's an artery, and it has a plaque in it. Cholesterol plaque. And the germs that you have in your body can destabilize or soften this plaque so that it ruptures. It just ruptures and its contents spill out into your bloodstream. Well, that's bad news because a ruptured plaque is then a threat for a heart attack or a stroke. So if you know you have some kind of germ in your body, do what you can to rid yourself of it. What about chlamydia? Chlamydia has become one of the most common of certain types of problems, such as respiratory diseases. It's responsible for up to 40% of pneumonias that occur in a community. It can also be spread by sexual contact. And the trachomatous germ, while it's less common, it can be spread by direct contact from person to person or by sexual contact. Now, what about antibiotics? Do they help you not to have a heart attack? They may, but it's thought to be not very likely. May have some benefit, but not a great deal. Probably not enough to make it worth your taking the risk of taking the antibiotic. Okay. Now let's do a little bit on high blood pressure. We've talked some about the causes of high blood pressure, and now is examination time. What would you say from what you already know about what we've been talking about today? What do you already know that would let you know what the cause is for essential hypertension? Now let me just write this word on the board. Essential hypertension. What does essential hypertension mean? Essential hypertension means high blood pressure. Essential? And what does the word essential in essential hypertension? You go to your doctor, you already know your blood pressure is high, and you go to your doctor and he says, you have essential hypertension. What does that word essential mean? No known cause. High blood pressure from no known cause. Well, it still goes by the name of essential hypertension, but now we know a cause. What's your cause? What's the cause? What's the cause? Who knows? You do know. All of you know. What's the cause? all of those things that you're mentioning, being overweight, drinking coffee, lack of exercise, all of those things are factors, but I'm looking for the physiologic cause. Stiff blood vessels, yes. What makes the blood vessels stiff? That's what I'm looking for.
The cholesterol level.
May not be cholesterol, may not be plaque. How about insulin resistance? Insulin resistance gives us essential hypertension. So the basic problem down under all these others is insulin resistance. That is caused, insulin resistance is caused by heredity and certain lifestyle factors. Diet, the drinks, the beverages that we may drink, the getting overweight, the inactivity that we have, and so forth. Lifestyle factors help us to express a full-blown heart attack or high blood pressure or stroke from the insulin resistance that we have. Okay, high blood pressure, the silent killer. What is high blood pressure? What represents high blood pressure? Anything above 120 over 80 is above the ideal, and if it gets above 140 over 90, we then call it high blood pressure. But I like to see people's blood pressure well below 120 over 80. That's optimal. And the lower the better. Oh, but my blood pressure runs 70 over 40. You might say, somebody might say, my blood pressure runs 70 over 40. What would you say about that? Now, this is a trick question, so don't answer too quickly. It is a low blood pressure. Is it a problem? No, it's not a problem. It's not a problem. Now, such a person may be a bit more susceptible to things like dehydration. We talked about dehydration the other day and how chronic dehydration is a factor in a number of diseases, and we want to avoid it. A person who becomes chronically dehydrated or acutely dehydrated, who also has a blood pressure of 70 over 40, may become symptomatic sooner than a person whose blood pressure is 120 over 80 or even 140 over 90. But they might not, because the person whose blood pressure is 140 over 90 who gets dehydrated, the reduction in blood pressure may cause symptoms because their body recognizes a need for a blood pressure of 140 over 90 unless you take certain other measures. So low blood pressure is not a problem. In fact, it's desirable. The best that the cardiologists know, the lower the blood pressure, the better it is for the person. Okay, the aftermath of hypertension, strokes, aneurysm. That's a little bubble on a blood vessel. You can get an aneurysm in the blood vessels in your brain, in your aorta, in your abdomen, in your chest, and wherever you get an aneurysm, it's bad news. Heart attack, retinal disease, such as blindness from retinal separation, retinal artery spasm or disease, kidney disease, hardening of the arteries, congestive heart failure, and poor mental function. If you lower your blood pressure just a little bit, just 3 millimeters, that's not much, is it? But you lower your blood pressure on a regular basis, just 3 millimeters. There's 11% fewer strokes, 7% fewer heart attacks, and 5% fewer deaths. It's well worth working at getting even a small reduction in your blood pressure. But 3 millimeters, we don't have to be content with that. We can get much more than that. We can get 15, 30, even 100 points reduction in blood pressure simply by making some lifestyle changes. Okay. What about blood sugar levels? What is normal blood sugar level? Well, 60 to 85 is probably ideal. 70 to 85, probably ideal. If you're below 70, that's not good. If you're above 85, that's not good. Again, let's say you are 85. Your level is 85. And you bring it down to 82. That's 3. It's bringing it down 3. Just like here, bringing the blood pressure down 3 points. Here you've brought the blood sugar down 3 points. Just bringing the blood sugar down 3 points will also reduce the total level of your insulin. Reducing insulin, which we can think of as being an irritant in the blood vessels, reducing insulin increases the length that you will live, decreases the likelihood of heart attacks, strokes, diabetes, and so forth. And so it's well worthwhile to work at getting just even small increments of reduction in blood sugar or in blood pressure. Yes. That's the fasting. Yeah, fasting blood sugar. Okay. All right. Now, how do we treat hypertension? It's work on salt, work on sugar, work on cheese. In fact, I would say leave off cheese. I consider cheese to be inedible. It's a rotted substance, a rotted food. It's been rotted for some weeks. Food is food that's left out for weeks and rotted. It's not fit to eat anymore, is it? And so we need to recognize cheese as a rotted food. Yes. How about these replacement vegetarian cheese? Aren't they wonderful? I wish I could endorse them, but often they are no better. They're also aged, and they also have fats that may be on the rancid side. So we have to worry about the vegetarian cheeses too. Yeah, I'm concerned about them. Why don't you just make your cheese in your own kitchen? They're easy to do. Many recipes for cheese. You can almost make a cheese in your kitchen as quickly as you can go to the market, and the time that's spent in searching around in the store for just what you want, putting it in your basket, taking it off at the counter, waiting for them to ring it up, all of that kind of thing takes time. Well, it takes a little time in your kitchen to make the cheese, but not that much more time than it does to go through all this extra time that you have to spend in buying it and bringing it home and storing it and all of that, do you see? So I say, just make your own cheeses. They don't taste exactly like dairy cheese, but they taste good, and so you'll accept them when you know that you're not having to eat a food that's not good for you.
Those
yes.
cheeses also have caffeinated in
them. Yes. There's many of these cheeses called vegetarian cheese, and non-dairy cheese will still have sodium caseinate or essentially non-fat dry skim milk. And so that's not something good for us to take anyway. It's been aged just like the full dairy product. Yes.
I noticed them here also the vinegar. What about balsamic vinegar?
What about what kind of vinegar?
Balsamic?
Yes. If it has an acid in it like acetic acid, and most vinegars are acetic acid, then it's an irritant. Spices are such things as ginger, cinnamon, nutmeg, cloves, black and red pepper. Okay. All right. We've got, that's probably right at the end. One thing that I could recommend to you is that you increase magnesium if you have high blood pressure. You may even want to take a magnesium supplement. And there are certain herbs that you can take. We've written a book on hypertension and its natural treatment, and it's available at New Lifestyle Books. All right. I hope that you have learned something about a very complicated subject. I can tell you very easily that Syndrome X is a common and very serious disease, but I wish I could tell you very simply what it is, but it's, as you can see, we sort of struggle to make it plain enough so that you can understand what insulin resistance is and sugar intolerance. All right, let's bow together and have a prayer. Loving and gracious Heavenly Father, thank you for the way that you have made us and for all of the wonderful aspects of our biochemistry and physiology. Help us to be knowledgeable about all these things and to be careful as we take care of the equipment which you have provided for us. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
You have been listening to another special American Cassette Ministries presentation. This recording has been digitally reprocessed from the original audio cassette in order to make this CD available. The audio quality was improved as much as possible. International copyright American Cassette Ministries, all rights reserved. To order CDs or audio cassettes of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 1-800-233-4450. International calls, please dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americancassette.org. There you will discover the largest selection of genuine Adventist preaching available. American Cassette Ministries is not a one-man band. It's an orchestra of outstanding speakers who are all on the same theological page. You can trust ACM. There's no compromise here. If American Cassette Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony. Our email address is info@americancassette.org. We'll share it with the speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and financial support are important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.